I was in downtown Chicago in the morning doing some tech work on my phone, and I noticed Chicago had been turned into a ghost town with COVID-19 government shutdown of businesses and all those office workers working from home and more real estate assessments coming. So the pressure is already intense on renters, property owners, and local governments and schools that want their tax money. And they want to get it, and they're going to take it. So it'll only get worse. And then Jeff Carlin called with the news that Boss Madigan, Mike Madigan, the con of the windswept wasteland of Illinois that we call Madiganistan, has now suspended his push to become Illinois House Speaker. Suspended. Whoa. He's been Speaker for decades, but he doesn't have enough vote from Democrats. And what with the federal corruption investigation, Springfield to Chicago, and that ComEd scandal, and he's the unindicted and uncharged official A in that $200 million scandal, and he's about, what, 16, 19 votes short? And now they're all hand-wringing in Springfield, not knowing what to do. I wonder, have you seen that movie Airplane? You know, the movie Airplane. There's a scene in it. I don't think it's suitable for young viewers, but maybe Jeff can do something to clean it up, where somebody shouts, "Can anybody fly this here plane?"
"This is due to periodic air pockets we encountered. There's no reason to become alarmed, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your flight.
By the way, is there anyone on board who knows how to fly a plane?"
Madigan and the Democrats have already flown it into the ground, and Illinois Combine Republicans, too, helped and put the nose of it right into the street in front of your house. That house with the for sale sign. So who's going to fly it? He hasn't withdrawn. He's just suspended his bid for Speaker, meaning absolute control over legislation and process in this broken state. It could be a bluff, you know. Suspend and then let them all fight it out and come to him later on bended knee and beg him to be their boss. Or it could just be the end. If the Democrats in power can't select a speaker, and the Republicans enter the picture at the start of the new session, Jim Durkin's got, what, 44 Republican votes? And the progressive Democratic women who are running for speaker can field about 16? I don't know. They'll all wait till they know someone has the votes, and then they'll all jump on and hail the new chief, or they'll hail the new boss begging for him to run. The way they used to beg Richard J. Daley to run for mayor every year, and he'd just sit there and say, "Oh, okay. Oh, you want me to run? Oh, okay, I'll do it this time for you." Illinois politicians without the con of Madiganistan is kind of like Yugoslavia without Stalin, and then without Tito. Think of what happened with Yugoslavia after Tito. They'll be stabbing backs and making deals. And who pays for all that? All those deals? And who has to pick up the cost of the backstabbing? You think they do? No. You do, because you live here. Professor Charles Lipson, professor emeritus from the University of Chicago, writer, thinker, columnist, is here. And I thought we were going to talk about revolutionary France in the time of the purges. Oh, wait, no. We're talking about 2021 in the time of the purges. And the silencing of dissent. And just what happens when 74 million people believe they are kicked to the margins of society. And as always, my buddy Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer of WGN Radio, and Master Baker. And I think, Jeff, just like my aunts, who are now long past, used to make a big tray of caldo burrico to serve at family dinners when we were fighting, I think you're going to have to make a tray I think you're going to have to learn how to make out the booty call. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, I think, still. Member of its editorial board, still. And where are you? With Illinois as Yugoslavia after Tito, and nobody can fly this here plane. And you're paying for a ticket, you're up there going, When is it going to crash? When is it going to crash? You're here with us on the ground, sitting around the table. Charles Lipson, Jeff Carlin, and me on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
I promised you that we'd have someone to put all this in context. And so I bring you Charles Lipson, the Peter B. Rietsma Professor of Political Science Emeritus at the University of Chicago, where he founded the program on international politics, economics, and security. He wrote a piece right after what happened in Washington, and I wanted to commend him for it. I do so privately because he's my friend, but also publicly because I appreciate it. Writing without waiting for consensus. There are plenty of people who are cowards in this world and will wait until they have consensus from others to buttress their points of view. Charles Lipson didn't do that when he wrote for The Spectator, "This is not what a constitutional republic looks like." And we bring you on the Chicago Way one of our favorite guests, Professor Charles Lipson. Good day, sir.
It's great to hear from you, John. We talked a little before we went on the air about our experience in dealing with that sad day. I began that article by saying that January the 6th, 2021 is a day that will live in infamy. That's exactly what I thought, you know, literally instantaneously. I was very pleased, actually proud of America, when the Congress resumed that day, didn't wait a day to go ahead and finish the important business of ratifying the president. But you and I both experienced something that other Americans might not have seen, because we're both in the public eye, and we write, and people can respond to us, people who we don't know and who are not our friends, as I say, IRL in real life. And over the past 4 years, as I supported a number of Trump's policies, I was never a kind of in the basket for him as a person. I always thought about the policies and whether the policies were good or bad. And I supported quite a few of them, the tax cuts, the deregulation, tougher policy toward China and Iran, for example. But I opposed him on some other things. And almost all of the people who were liberals had blocked me, gotten rid of me on social media. You know, they just didn't want to hear any of that, none of it. And then what happened after last week, actually about 10 days ago, I wrote that President Trump ought to attend the inauguration. This is before he had announced that he would not, on the grounds that it was the most prominent symbol of constitutional continuity, and that when the he was not legally obliged to do it, but that if he did it, he would be signaling that he was not the resistance, he was the loyal opposition. And then after the events of the day on Wednesday, I wrote another article that was critical of the behavior of Trump. I don't know whether you'd go so far as to say he incited it, but he certainly didn't do anything to dampen it. And he had called people to Washington and riled them all up and so forth. And the vitriol that I received from the right was like nothing I'd ever seen before. I was called a traitor. I was told to kill myself. I mean, it was just awful. And, you know, while I take all of that under consideration, you know, and I'm trying to check, some people think that my parents were not actually married at the time of my birth and so forth. But I mean, my Lord, it just was awful. Did you receive the same sort of thing, John?
Well, I've been receiving it every day for 25 years. When I'd write and rail against the Democrats in power in Chicago, the Daily Machine, I was called a traitor. When I condemned the Republicans for in the combine, either here or in Washington, called a traitor. And now the left wants me silenced once again and offers up some rather unsavory recommendations for my future. The point being, though, that this is what we get when we're in the public eye. What it tells me, besides the fact that Twitter is a sewer, and is that the nation is split. And I don't think the left understands the Trump people. I don't think they want to. I also supported pretty much a lot of things that Trump did, because whether he was transactional and just trying to put, you know, pieces of a coalition together amorally, or whether or not it suited what I thought was best for the country. Constitutional republic supports the Constitution, hence originalist, constitutionalist, textualist judges and the Supreme Court. The support of Israel rather than the support of Iran. The building of alliances between Israel and the Arab states, which I thought was impossible at one time. Deregulation, the economy, all that. What I never liked was Trump's mannerisms or his off-putting ways, his temperamental nature, but I thought we could get through it. I thought we could get through it, and clearly, now that he's imploded, what you're seeing is the big state, the Democrats, and people on the left who once considered themselves civil libertarians, Charles, are now all about censorship, the censorship on Twitter. They're ecstatic that Trump has been silenced. But I wonder if you can silence the president of the United States, what's next for the nation?
You know, after the last election in 2016, the New York Times and a lot of major publications spent a few weeks in anguish, not just about the election of Trump. Of course, they were distraught about that, but saying we had misreported this. We simply didn't understand half the country. They got over that very quickly. But they didn't even bother with that this time. Did you notice that there was none of this 74 million people voted for Trump? How did we miss that? How did we not report it? And I thought it was all kind of summarized in Anderson Cooper's awful remark about Trump supporters, that they can go back to Olive Garden. You know, this from
some Marriott.
In the Marriott and the Holiday Inn. Yeah. I mean, that this is somebody who would stay at the Ritz, right? And who would.
He's a Vanderbilt, Charles.
He's a Vanderbilt. But I mean, you can be well to do. You can have a PhD. You can be a prominent lawyer or whatever you are, and not have contempt for your fellow Americans. I mean, some who are calling everybody they don't like a Stalin or a Hitler or something, that deserves contempt. But most, and people who raid the Capitol or people who want to firebomb the courthouse in Portland, Oregon over the summer and so forth, those deserve contempt. But most people don't. And we've got to restore that sense that we're fellow citizens.
How do we do that? I'm reading again. I recommend it to all of you. This is not what a constitutional republic looks like. Charles Lipson's view on the day of infamy, although I, unlike Charles Schumer, I will not compare it to Pearl Harbor. I see it as, I don't want to see things, look at things separately. I want to look at things in context. And I'll give you something that a reader told me, very angry reader, when I condemned Trump for egging on the mob.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we've watched our cities burn. We've watched Democrats excuse it and the media tell us we're fools for objecting to it. We've seen the looting in Chicago that killed the downtown and other cities. We've seen business owners beaten half to death. We saw that police officer in St. Louis shot in the looting. And we're told it was mostly peaceful. How dare you, John Cass, to take that side? And I think I'm still going to take that side because I see.
Well, he's right up until the last sentence. Yeah. Oh. He's right up until the last sentence. And it was a violent summer. And the fact that there was not only very little punishment, no pushback from the Democrats, they didn't mention it at their convention and all the rest, is a way of saying, if you're violent and unlawful, but we agree with your purposes, that's fine. And that's not fine. We need to restore that sense. I mean, there is the common theme here that's been true for a long time, is people don't think that there's an even-handed sense of justice. Now, what's different? It is different to attack the Magnificent Mile and to attack the United States Capitol. And it's very different to attack the United States Capitol when they're in the midst of certifying an election, completing the election. And it's different when the President of the United States actually actively eggs them on. So I don't think that they're quite equivalent. But you asked the question, but I do think that they're linked and related, and that people who want to restore things need to think about even-handedness. But you ask about, how do we get back? And I would say that the single most important distinction, and you sort of have to ask yourself where you stand on this spectrum, is between those of us who are shocked and saddened and those people who are angry and vengeful about what has happened. What has happened could mean one thing for you, Jeff Carlin, and a different thing for John Cass, and a different thing for Charles Lipson. But I'm mostly sad, troubled, disturbed about the continuity of our constitutional republic, and I want to restore that, restore that sense of law and order. And I don't think we can get back to comity, but I do think we can move past revenge. So I and the other people who I think, and I think it was a terrible thing for Nancy Pelosi to move for an impeachment. And the reason is not the substantive arguments that you can make one way or the other, but I think it just pulls the scab off once again. In retrospect, Gerald Ford looks very wise in how he handled the scandal that he inherited when Nixon left office. He decided to put it behind him and look forward and pardon Nixon rather than try to carry on all the legal remedies that might be possible. Gerald Ford received a lot of criticism at the time. He was right, however. And I think that we need to think about that as we move forward, not to excuse what happened, but to begin to think in a forward-looking way about how to put things back together.
Hey, but Charles, wouldn't you say the difference there is that Ford got the choice to make there then and say, hey, we need, as a president, which is what you want out of an executive, to be the voice of common sense and the, and hopefully, you know, the American thought. To do that, I think they're right in calling an impeachment because
oh God.
What John?
No, Jeff. I want to hear it. I want to hear Jeff. Jeff, I'm sorry. I just reacted.
I was kidding, Jeff. I was kidding. It was about the cancel culture. Go ahead.
But my point being is that in the annals of history, when we're looking back, this president Donald Trump completely bungled the authority and the power of his office in those last times. I mean, we can say that he screwed up, and the Congress only has one tool to essentially. I mean, they could censure him, but that's not really. That's general. He's not going to come talk to Congress. How often has he talked to Congress? So by impeaching him, just making the vote on the floor, it puts a check mark in history, saying that this president overstepped his bounds. Future presidents need to beware of what he did and why it was wrong. And when they look back at this moment, they see that as this is the people's vote. This is what people did. They took the House. They took the Senate. And they clearly, as Democrats, but they should, they clearly feel he did something egregious, and it should be labeled in history as such. Because otherwise, we're as history of our nation, we're just following or using either intellectuals or media or other representatives lay the record. And I think that they at least have to do that. And I think Biden would be a fool for not pardoning him and not stopping the whole progress as it was. Because it is dangerous to our republic to further down that path, because it would lead uncertainly to a civil war. That's my take on it.
You want me to respond?
Mm-hmm.
I understand your desire for condemning him officially. What he did, egging on the mob, was unconscionable, unspeakable. But he spoke those words and told them to march down to the Capitol and protest. When I read...
To get rid of the weak Congress members, John.
Get rid of the weak Congress members and all that, which I, Jeff, pardon me, but which I condemned him for an hour after he said so in print in the Chicago Sun-Times. I mean, Tribune, where I worked. But the impeachment is a different matter. I would rather see, if you must have something like that, the Congress may censor him, and condemn him, and condemn the behavior of the mob that broke into the Capitol. And I think that the people who broke in there should be punished and imprisoned. However, the impeachment is another thing altogether. And I don't think it serves the interest of putting the country back together by impeaching him any more than I see. Jeff, after 9/11, after the horrific bombing by terrorists of our nation on that day, we were united for a few seconds as a country. And then an amazing thing happened. There were those in power who took advantage of the raw emotions of the people to push policy agendas that they wanted to see done. So I'm gonna accept or set aside the wars in Iraq, et cetera, because I've apologized for supporting them many, many times. But the issue that concerns me now is what I saw when people allowed themselves to support the rise of the surveillance state, the rise of the cameras, the loss of their liberty and their individual liberties, the searching of your cell phones and all that. And I see it again happening with the censorship of the president by Twitter, by Parler, all this stuff going on with big tech trying to shut down debate. I don't see that as I'm trying to look at this as if I were at the head of the table on Sunday dinner and I had my cousins Johnny and Angie and Connie on the left and my cousins Pete and me on the right and all the uncles and aunts who were, you know, they were Roosevelt Democrats, they were Hoover Republicans, and so forth. I want to see the country back together again, and I don't see impeaching him serves that purpose. I think censorship does.
But you mentioned presidents in that, John, and the presidents are the one that people looked up to, and the presidents are one that really influenced those people. And give this president the chance to do that, to be that man, because you're discounting the fact that he's going to do the right thing. And I think he does the right thing and pardon him outright, and then it's over. And then
you said the right thing was impeaching, though, didn't you?
For Congress and for the president is to pardon him.
Let me weigh in on a couple of points here. I think the first point to remember is that the impeachment of this president has really been a four-year project of the Democrats. So you're not coming to this as if it's something new. They've really been out to remove him from office, not just oppose him, but remove him from office to say that his presidency is not legitimate. That was the whole point of saying he colluded with Russia to get elected. They knew within, you know, a few months of the Mueller report beginning that wasn't true, and Mueller didn't release that. They tried to impeach him on that. That failed because all the senior Obama officials testifying under oath had said that there was no evidence of that, and Mueller's team couldn't find any evidence. And then Schiff and Pelosi kept all that secret while they were saying something else in public. Then they did try to impeach him over the Ukraine phone call, and now this. So it's not as if this won't be seen as you may link it, and a lot of people may link it specifically to what he did that was so wrong on the 6th of January and in the week or so leading up to it. But I think a lot of people will also see it as part of a long-term project of the Democrats to seek vengeance on the president. The second thing I would say is that it's not as if we're coming to this with a year left in his presidency, where if he were not impeached, he would see this as some kind of implicit endorsement of this behavior, and it might embolden that behavior going forward with a year or more left in his presidency. He's got whatever it is, less than 10 days left in his presidency. That also means that there won't be any hearings in the House. There would just be a rushed floor vote. And then in the Senate, which is not in session now, so they can't even receive the articles of impeachment until the 19th of January when they reconvene, according to Mitch McConnell. And then you have to begin with a Senate trial. And fairness requires that the president and his side be able to present all of their case. Now, I want you to think about what that means. It means that as a new administration is starting, the Biden administration, on the 20th of January, you're going to spend the next week, 2 weeks, whatever, however long it takes, impeaching the president rather than looking to the beginning of a new administration. That's why I was kind a bit surprised the other day when Joe Biden said, look, I don't have any opinion on this. This is all a matter for the Congress. I just want to concentrate on what my administration is doing. I think he's quickly going to find that that this will begin to suck up all the oxygen in the room. He'll be able to do things. He'll be able to use that obscurity to send out a lot of executive orders that may get a lot less notice. He may like that, but I think it will, roil the nation. There won't be time for a serious debate. It will look as if it's the extension of months, even years of Democratic opposition to Trump rather than something that's specifically directed at his breaching our constitutional norms.
Jeff?
No, I don't know. What do you want from me, John? I mean, if I I'm going to get it again from you.
No. No one's accusing you or getting. We're
John,
friends
come on.
Here.
I mean, I say something and I say, "Oh God!" And then I get a derisive lecture from you. Like I'm the guy. I mean, I don't know what you want from me.
I will say. Let me say one more thing. I'm glad that the 26th Amendment is not being considered. And I think that all of the talk of it over the administration has been misplaced. The 26th Amendment was passed in the aftermath of President Kennedy's assassination, and it did two things. The first thing it said is if the vice presidency is vacant, as it was when Lyndon Johnson became president, right? There was no sitting vice president at that point. That meant that the next person in line to become president would be the Speaker of the House. He said that you can appoint a new vice president with the majority approval of both the House and the Senate. So Gerald Ford was appointed under Nixon after Spiro Agnew resigned in disgrace after taking bribes, right? And then when after Nixon resigned and Ford became president, Nelson Rockefeller was appointed. So that was one part of the amendment. The other said if the president is unable to continue in office and that you can, the majority of the cabinet and so forth can vote to temporarily remove him so you have an acting president in his place. And that was really designed to address something that had happened at the end of World War One, when Woodrow Wilson had a very severe stroke and was bedridden for over a year, and it was unclear who was really acting on behalf of the president.
His wife.
Yeah, exactly. Edith
His
Wilson.
Wife was boss, right?
Edith Wilson. But it didn't say he's unfit for office. It said he's unable to go forward. And I think it was people who were trying to use it as an end run around a formal impeachment proceedings were wrong. I understand what Jeff is saying. Look, it's two against one, and he's made his argument. I guess my point now is I would rather see us try to get through the next week or so and muddle through and then move forward with a sense that a common sense, maybe not universally held, that President Trump leaves office in disgrace over what he did in the last week, not over his whole presidency, but over what he has done since November, which is to call into question the legitimacy of the election of a new president, Joseph Biden.
Jeff, if I'm sorry for the tone, okay? I'm very sorry for the tone. I didn't mean it to be a tone against you. I was thinking of basically all those people on my Twitter feed who are saying all sorts of things, and I was, I guess, responding to them rather than to you personally. I hope you understand that, and I apologize for any hurt or feelings on your behalf that I was in.
Thanks, Jeff.
That's what we need more of, actually, in the public sphere. You know, Jeff put his comments in a very thoughtful way, and your apology for appearing to him, I don't think you intended it.
No, John, I did not.
But appearing to him to be harsher in not your views about the specific issue, but in response to him personally, that's what we need more of. That's a model.
What we need is for Jeff Carlin, who is a baker, to bake me a nice, bake us both some burrito, like my aunts would do, to settle the differences between the right and the left at our dinner tables every Sunday. So, Jeff, I happily await that caldo burrito, which I cannot eat, as you know.
Yeah, I do.
All right, one thing I'd like to ask you both, you know, given the great philosopher of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, who said a crisis, we should not let a crisis go to waste because it can help us do things we could not do before. I point out Glenn Greenwald, the by no means conservative, right? A writer of the left, who's concerned about civil liberties, where I think many people on the left are not. And he had a tweet the other day about Jennifer Palmieri. Jennifer Palmieri is a former Obama spokesperson and muckety-muck in the Democratic Party. And he says, let me read these two. He says, longtime Clinton aide and Democratic operative, meaning Jennifer Palmieri.
And John. And,
yes, sir.
Not just an aide. I mean, she pretty much ran Hillary's Into the Forest campaign.
And yeah.
She is by far an authority on losing.
He says about her, longtime close Clinton aide and Democratic operative, explicitly boasting that Facebook and other Silicon Valley monopolies are now censoring conservatives because Dems, meaning Democrats, are now in charge of Congress and they want to aggrandize their power, he meant. And here's her tweet. Here's Jennifer Palmieri's tweet. It has not escaped my attention that the day social media companies decided there actually is more they could do to police Trump's destructive behavior was the same day they learned Democrats would chair all the congressional committees that oversee them. Now, I find this, gentlemen, to be astounding, but also brutally honest from the Democrat Palmieri in that.
Does it, John, doesn't it sound like nice children you have there, Mr. Cass? I'd hate to see anything happen to them.
Why don't we see your kids in the front yard? Yeah.
Yeah.
But it also tells me that the larger implication here is that
The big tech wants to curry favor with the Democrats, so they silence conservatives. At least that's the argument. And by silencing conservatives, by banning them off Twitter, they hope to, and Facebook and so forth, they hope to stave off any regulations that might treat them like the way they don't want to be treated, but the way I think people like Josh Hawley, the senator of Missouri, and also the senator from the Commonwealth, Liz Warren, liberal Democrat, want them to be treated. And I find this whole business of piling on Josh Hawley partly a result of big tech not wanting to deal with it. And so he's being destroyed before he can run for president. What do you think?
I mean, I'll jump on that. I think you're to the point of them, whether or not they can, you know, keep saying, oh, that they're breaking a right to free speech. Twitter is by banning people is kind of a disillusionment and not showing people's inability to understand the Constitution. But I think the bigger point is that, in my opinion, and the political thing you're speaking to with Hawley is absolutely right. I think they're trying to take him down because you're right. He is a rising star and very well spoken. I think that something like Twitter and Facebook and these social media platforms need to be considered like telecoms. I mean, we have restrictions in place because we know how easily and the power that these things wield can be manipulated by a few. And I'm all for that. And the idea that we can, you know, censor people from platforms that reach millions of people is just crazy, because that's not what this country was founded on. And people had the right to use the, you know, accolade or the influence they have in people, how they see fit. And it just shows bare that social media needs to be regulated like a regular telecom.
Charles, what do you think the effect will be if this wave of purges and silencing and censorship continues, partisan, like the Jacobin mobs running through the streets of Paris in the 1780s looking for Mademoiselle Laballe to cut off her head, what is the effect, long-term effect on the Republic?
It's terrible, but I would say that the thing to recognize is that it's not just that the country is evenly divided. It looks like we're a two-hump camel, not a one-hump camel. That is,
it's definitely a humping camel, yeah.
The thing about the two-hump camel is that there's nothing in the middle. And we need to restore, not moderation in the sense that people need to have moderate views. I really don't. I don't want to tell people what to think. But I do think that we need to have respect for each other to make genuine arguments, not just hurl names at each other, except for people who really are threatening each other, urging violent insurrection, things like that. I do think that that's coloring way outside the lines of a constitutional republic. The whole thing kind of reminded me of the final scene in an older novel by Nathaniel West called Day of the Locust, in which everybody is kind of marching down the street in this frenzied mob, and they're not quite sure what they're marching about. I guess a final thought on a lot of this is that the country is very evenly divided. And when the country is pretty evenly divided, it seems like a poor time to undertake really massive social public policies that would change a lot of things, but have only support from one side and not the other. It was a big problem with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. It was the first major program in modern American history passed with only one party's support. And the other party was just consistently against it. I think President Obama and his side realized that once you began the program and embedded a national health insurance program into our public policy, it would be impossible to get rid of. And they were they've so far proven correct. But I think that moving forward with a series of tendentious policies that are supported only by a very thin majority in the House and the Senate would just roil the country further. And I think we're likely to get that in some social policies.
What happened in the riots of the summer in large part was that the liberal Democrats who ran the cities were being devoured by the hard left that was trying to take over the politics of the Democratic Party and succeeded. And so, but that we couldn't even discuss it. I mean, I wrote about it, but the left didn't want to hear that because that, I think that's what
it you were accused of being racist and anti-Semitic, because you noticed that a lot of the riots were supported by Black Lives Matter, and the state's attorneys that refused to do any of the prosecution were these Justice Democrats, many of whom had been funded in a very visible program by George Soros. So, but again, that's the kind of name calling that has substituted for real arguments. You can't have a situation where people can go smashing windows of stores, looting them.
Or smashing careers, right?
Yeah, smashing careers, harming people, no punishment at all, and then expect everything is just going to return to normal and that the other side won't say, well, you know, it's law of the jungle out there. And that's exactly my fear. We need to restore that. And it's not going to be restored by people who prosecutors in St. Louis and San Francisco and Cook County, Illinois, who say you can steal up to $1,000 and we'll just give you a tap on the hand.
It will be restored when American people start treating each other like a family. Like a family sitting around a dinner table arguing, but still in love with each other, right? And we've lost that, I think, largely, Jeff and Charles, because of our institutions have broken down. And I would say the left has helped break those down, but let's say it just happened that way. The institutions break down. The moral authority of religious leaders breaks down. Right. Our concern for each other becomes now how best we can dominate them. And the fact that, okay, 80 million people voted for Biden and 75 million voted for Trump. And guess what? We're all here in the same country. And I agree with you both, and I think both of you are concerned, and so am I.
Jeff, I feel like you really ought to get the last word, my friend, because you've been a bit outnumbered today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks. Well, obviously, it's always an honor to talk, to have these conversations with you both. So I always end these things and talk to my dad later in the day, which I will today. And salute to you both and having intellectual thought, because that's always an honor. I echo both you and the idea that I know our republic is in trouble, and I know the things, everything we've seen over the last 6 months, 12 months, 4 years, and beyond has signaled lots of terrible things to come, and that stuff worries me, and I just. And as time looks back on, or history looks back on what we do and who we are as a nation, I hope people can see the big picture and the forest for the trees for what makes us a country that can adjust and move with time and come out on top. That's always my hope. Regardless of your politics.
Very well put. My sense is that The phrase to remember is that famous phrase, that famous answer that Benjamin Franklin gave when he left the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, which had been a closed convention for the whole summer. People didn't know what was being decided.
Which involved lots of fisticuffs and arguing.
Yes, yes. But when he left, a woman asked him, what do we have, a monarchy or a republic? And today that question would be, what do we have, a dictatorship or a republic? And Benjamin Franklin's answer famously was, a republic if you can keep it. And I think that that's the answer to remember. These things are not writ in stone. They have to be replenished with some sense of public trust and public officials we can trust, and not just in government, but in churches and civic organizations and all the rest. There's been a breakdown of that trust over time, been a breakdown of trust in the media. And we need to begin restoring that, not in one area, but in many areas.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that it's highly reported that, or largely reported rather, that Franklin said that to a female reporter, if you will, a woman who was a women's group. I've seen that. And in this day and age, if we didn't say that, I'd feel like we might be tarred and feathered. So let me put that out there.
Great to talk to all of you. Great to talk to all of you.
Or Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, my friend who will bake us Gato Burrito next time we see each other. And for Charles Lipson, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, thanks for being here on the Chicago Way. Okay?
Perfect. Perfect. Always fun. I really love doing this. I hate to stay up this late, but I'm willing to do it.
Jeff, okay. Now's the time you missed your coffee and whiskey.
I know.
I didn't know that you were a Pacino man. You know what a Pacino is, right?
I have no idea.
That's you take the Italians when they would drive the snow plows in Chicago back in the day when they were ethnic jobs. They called it Pacino. They would take coffee and pour some brandy or, you know, something in there to sweeten it when they were plowing the streets because it was so cold.
You guys, have you
an Irish family? We just call it whiskey in coffee.
Do you guys ever eat grits?
Oh, I love grits.
Okay.
Shrimp and grits, baby.
Cheese grits.
Okay. Oh. So now, since you're talking about this, have you ever heard of red eye gravy?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know what it is?
Yeah.
What is it? I don't know.
You saute up your ham with a little butter.
Oh, yeah.
And then what you do is you pour just a little coffee in it.
There you go. Yeah.
And that's why they call it red eye gravy.
Coffee? Is coffee the...
Just a little. Just a little.
So coffee's the deglazing agent when you saute a piece of ham?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Not much, but just a little. But, of course, you reminded me of it when you were talking about the coffee with the whiskey.
Betty, please make some red-eyed gravy now. I have money for that.
Okay, good to talk to you guys.
See you, buddy. Bye.
See you, Charles.
Well, that was lively. And Jeff Carlin, master baker and also executive producer of WGN Radio, promises, I hope, at least I hope I'm not forcing him, he's my friend, I love him, to bake us a Gato Burrito, probably Gato Burrito for all the listeners, so that we can sit down and talk and not fight with each other. And for Professor Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago, and a great writer and intellect who tries to put things and does put things into perspective. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, still member of its editorial board still. I'm not taking the buyout. No, sorry. I'm not doing it. So all you people who hate me out there, you're going to have to deal with it. Thanks for being here on another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.